This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Today we're in Los Angeles to examine the complex relationship between architecture and the silver screen.
Film has made a big step away from print because you can not only show the space and time, but you can also tell the backstory, the people involved.
We sit down with the founder of the Architecture and Design Film Festival in LA to discuss Tinseltown's take on the built environment. Plus,
I am convinced the role of the architect is to do work of consequence. Bring aesthetics, but also recognize the importance of engaging the city in multiple ways.
We meet the Los Angeles-based architect mulling over the space, light and form of a remarkable new housing project in an up-and-coming area. All that to come right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. First up, we're in the City of Angels. To celebrate Monocle's new office and shop opening in Culver City, I took the opportunity to head to Hollywood to scent a few design-minded scoops. One thing that caught my eye was the architectural regeneration of the long-overlooked high-rises and gridded streets of downtown, where I stayed for much of my visit. The area was a fitting venue for the now-finished Architecture and Design Film Festival, which stopped off here for a week last month. It was there that I caught up with the show's first guests for a discussion about architecture and the silver screen. I was joined by Kyle Bergman, the director of the film festival, and also Christopher Hawthorne, Los Angeles' chief design officer. He'll explain what that is a little later. Hawthorne also wrote and directed one of the films featuring in the festival entitled That Far Corner, a meditation about Frank Lloyd Wright's LA houses and how they represent a shift in the maestro's career. I started our mini round table, recorded at Los Angeles Theatre Center downtown, by asking Kyle about the aim and urgency of hosting such an event.
So as architects, we talk to ourselves all the time, and it's super interesting. But what we're not so good at is expanding that conversation. And so seeing films together is that great opportunity. And we program films that are both interesting to the design professional as well as the general public. And the goal of the festival is to bring those two worlds together, watch a film, have a drink, have a conversation, talk, argue, discuss. And the hope is to lift the design IQ of America to as high as Holland or Denmark.
And Chris, I'm going to come to you. You have a rather august career behind you and still ahead of you, one hopes, writing for the LA Times, being an architecture critic. I suppose marrying that intellectual enthusiasm for the built environment with a bit of a public touch about the kind of things that people find interesting. How important is the Architecture Film Festival, do you think, to raising that level of discourse?
Well, I was felt lucky to be part of it in a very small way in earlier years as part of panel discussions talking about the films and talking about the themes, the subjects that the films raised. And I think Los Angeles, this is part of the job that I do now in the mayor's office. In part, the job is about lifting the level of civic discourse around architecture and design. And there's probably no city that needs that kind of conversation more and has fewer platforms for that kind of discussion than Los Angeles does. So many fundamental things about the future of the city hang in the balance, I think, in the next, let's say, 10 to 20 years. But we don't have the kinds of institutions, the kinds of platforms for that kind of broadly public, wide-ranging conversation about architecture and design. So I think of the festival as filling part of that niche in a really important way.
And Kyle, back to you. I'm interested in the relationship between architecture, the built environment, the feeling that you have when the light hits a wall, when you walk into a space, and I suppose the art of filmmaking, where you have to isolate those experiences, kind of play them out in 2D, but still make the association with the people that live there, the life of these buildings. I was having a bit of a moan beforehand about architecture books that just show buildings as shapes, but, you know, how do you get people invested in the idea of space and tactility and the form of buildings when it comes to the medium of film? Big question, but we'll see.
Film is a great opportunity. I mean, up until people were making a lot of films, you know, photography was the way that the general public experienced architecture outside of going to it, which is always the best way. There's nothing better than going to see architecture live. But if you have to have it represented in other ways, film has made a big step away from print and photography because you can not only show the space and time and light and scale, but you can also tell the backstory, the front story. You can talk about the people involved. We have a unique Danish film called The Human Shelter, and it's about looking at shelter. What does it mean? What's the value of shelter? What defines home? And the first scene of it is out in northern Norway, and there's this man and his daughter who are reindeer herders, and they're sitting in a kind of a little mobile home on sleds, and they're having this beautiful home scene out in the middle of nowhere, and that is their home, and it feels so much like home, and the idea of home and shelter is brought about in that film. We have Christopher Hawthorne's film, which is really looking at Frank Lloyd Wright. What's interesting about his film is there's been already so much said about Frank Lloyd Wright. What can you say new about it? And when I first saw it, I was like, okay, I always get a little skeptical when I see films on Frank Lloyd Wright. And Christopher really brought a whole different look at the L.A. houses. And it's a fascinating kind of angle of why are these houses so different than his other houses? And he takes a really deep dive, taking the viewers down a path of thinking about these buildings as a whole. And it's super fascinating.
The L.A. houses are muscular, they're brutal, they're romantic, you know, they're strange.
Why did L.A. elicit this kind of work from Frank Lloyd Wright?
They are not domestic in any conventional sense.
The answers make up a story more fascinating than I ever would have guessed.
I want to ask you a bit of a cheeky question. We're sitting in downtown Los Angeles. The influence of Hollywood is never far from many ideas about filmmaking in this fine city. Were you tempted to add a twist? Is there a big cliffhanger at the end, or is simply the life and work of an incredible American architect, does it speak for itself? How did you go about creating this film about Frank Lloyd Wright?
Kyle's right. There's been so much written in so many films, so many film treatments of his work. He's sort of like the architecture equivalent of Abraham Lincoln. There are more books written about Abraham Lincoln than all the other presidents combined, and I think the same is true with Wright when it comes to American architects. So certainly there is a bit of a twist or a mystery at the heart of the story. It begins with a really brutal murder of Wright's, really the love of his life, the woman that for whom he left his wife and six children and shut down his office and ran off to Europe. She was killed in really brutal fashion at Taliesin, the house that Wright had designed and built for the two of them in really his ancestral homeland in Wisconsin. And it was right after that he began making regular trips to Los Angeles and began to mine this really rich vein of pre-Columbian architecture in the houses that he designed in Los Angeles. And so it was really about wondering if there might be a connection between those two parts of his life story. And there have been relatively few attempts to try to stitch those two elements of, let's say, the first half of his career together. And what you mentioned about Hollywood is important. I was thinking about your earlier question. There's a particular significance of having the festival here in Los Angeles because of the shadow that Hollywood has cast on this relationship between filmmaking and architecture. And if you watch a famous documentary about that question, Los Angeles Plays Itself, by Tom Anderson from CalArts, he really makes, I think, the convincing argument that Hollywood has exploited the architecture of the built environment of Los Angeles to its own ends, has used Los Angeles to stand in for all kinds of other places, to do the bidding of all kinds of other thematic notions about character. And he, of course, makes a big deal about the fact that modernist houses in so many Hollywood films are owned by either the villains or the mentally unstable characters in a film.
Voice print identification. Your floor number, please.
Decker 97.
97, thank you.
And makes other kinds of connections about the parts of Los Angeles culture, the neighborhoods that have been left out of that story and have been not had a chance to appear on film. So it's all the more important to have these stories that are considering that question of how architecture is represented in Los Angeles, also a city which is so much, not just in Hollywood, in architecture itself, so much about image making. Think about the photographer Julia Shulman, for example, and how much his body of work was about selling a particular idea of architectural glamour in Los Angeles. So that relationship plays out in some very, I would say, some singular ways in Los Angeles. And so all the more surprising, I suppose, that so little had been explored about these houses. And of course, the houses themselves, the houses that designed and built here in the early 20s, many of them have made frequent appearances in Hollywood films, particularly the Ennis House. And it's one of the arguments I make in the film is that it was really artists and Hollywood filmmakers who have sensed something in the architecture that historians were overlooking. And that if you look at the ways in which the films have been used in films and TV shows, even in video games, that the creators of those cultural products have seen sort of what's right in front of our eyes, which is that there's something, there's a kind of dark or even somber cast to the work that historians have either overlooked or they've been perhaps more interested in other angles of the biography.
If I cast my mind back to when I last read one of those many books about Frank Lloyd Wright, he's a bit of a character, isn't he? He's terrible with money, always going against people's advice, always kind of proclaiming his own genius. To what extent, although you're pushing back against Hollywood overusing perhaps architecture, to what extent can an architecture film learn about that, you know, the art of entertainment, from bringing these characters back to life, showing that they're not the Hollyhock House sat on the top of a hill with, you know, security railings around it, showing that this was actually a living, breathing, interesting place that really pushed the envelope in some respects. Can you learn from Hollywood as well as reclaiming architecture from it?
Absolutely, and I think this is really a character study more than anything else. It's really thinking about where Wright was, what kind of mental and professional state he was in when he began making regular trips to Los Angeles, and seeing if there's any relationship between that state and the work itself to tease out. And that's really at the heart of the story that we're trying to tell in the documentary. And certainly he was a very flamboyant character. He sold a picture of flamboyance, maybe perhaps even a picture of sort of creative instability as part of his persona. He was very careful about how he was packaging. But he also had these moments of great and pure tragedy where it was just reactive. And he, you know, there's a, after the murders at Taliesin, and he talks about breaking out in boils. There's a kind of Job-like pure reaction where he's no longer in control of his own persona or on the trajectory of his own life. And I think that was particularly disturbing for him because he was a character who was so artful at packaging his own myth.
As Wright looked on the ruins of Taliesin, he began to see himself. The gaping black hole left by fire in the beautiful hillside, he wrote, was no less empty, charred, and ugly in my own life.
Certainly he recovered that a little bit when he got to Los Angeles. He was intensely interested in Hollywood and the ways in which Hollywood might provide a steady supply of clients that had begun to dry up in the Midwest, in part because of the scandal that had attended his decision to leave his wife and then the murders, of course. So he was trailing that scandal, trying to get away from it, trying to disappear, but also looking for new sources of work. And that the genius does play out in the particular choices that he made as an architect. He reminds me of a kind of prodigy or musical genius in the way that somebody like Mozart mastered the form of the symphony at a very early age and then sort of had to contrive tests for himself. And I think that's something that real geniuses are faced with. And the house that he designed in Pasadena, the Millard House, which was the first of these concrete block houses, the second house he designed in Los Angeles, there's a kind of perversion to the way in which he took a very flat lot and decided to push the house into the ravine on one edge of the house, as if to set, again, to give himself these tests to see if he could pass them. Because by that point in his career, the idea of a typical sort of quasi-suburban house for a, you know, respectable client, that was the kind of test that he'd passed dozens of times already in his career. So there is a sense in the house that he's looking for either gravity-defying or sort of convention-defying ways to push those talents a little bit and test himself.
And you lucky things, you can hear more from Kyle Bergman and Christopher Hawthorne a little later on in the show. Do stay with us. Next up, I decided to investigate another issue that's felt in cities around the world, but finding new expressions here in Los Angeles, the issue of housing. I went to visit a property called Mariposa 1038, a black and white squeezed box of a property that swirls around a curvilinear courtyard. The work of local practice, Lorcan O'Herlihy Architects, the building represents a rethinking of space, light, form and affordability in a city where house prices are soaring beyond what most people can afford. I caught up with LOHA's principal and namesake, Lorcan O'Herlihy, on the rooftop of Mariposa 1038 to find out a little more about this remarkable project.
My name is Lorcan O'Herlihy, principal of LOHA, also known as Lorcan O'Herlihy Architects, and we're sitting here at Mariposa 1038 in Koreatown.
And as I look one way, I can see the high-rises of downtown. As I look another way, I can see the Hollywood Hills. Tell me about this residential project that we're sat atop at the minute. When did it start? And what was the idea behind this rather remarkable building in Koreatown?
I was approached by a wonderful woman, June, who had been looking around the city for architects and came across a number of my projects. And she tracked me down and asked me to design this project. What's quite interesting about where we're sitting here right now is very important. It talks about the nature of our work. We try to engage the city in multiple ways. Being on the roof here, you engage the city in a very broader way, where you see the Hollywood Hills, you see the Hollywood sign, and really starts to embrace the idea that buildings also can take advantage of roofs and take advantage of how it engages and has a social and civic connectivity to cities. So that's what drives our work. And that's what drove this project. We have very dense building here in the sense that it's 32 units in a robust area in Koreatown where a number of very young people are moving to. And we wanted to give them an opportunity to stay in a place where they can afford and still walk to and engage the city in many ways.
Compared to most metropolitan areas, it's fairly sprawling, reasonably low density. How do you ensure affordability in an unaffordable area? How does the architect take on the role of, I guess, developer and realtor there?
Well, what we did here was to design the units so that they could conceivably also have tenants that are two individuals, and that way they could split the rent. Our client also, who owns the building, has committed to keeping the rent that's affordable to this area. Now, quite obviously, Los Angeles is an immensely expensive city, and that's something we have to accept. What's nice about this project is that some of the units are also for families. So you have families, you have people who are sharing units. It's a very creative group of people here. And that's something that drives the project, the client being committed to keep the units affordable. When I say affordable, they're not affordable housing, but they're affordable with a number of individuals being able to share the rent.
And radio being the ultimately imperfect medium for talking about architecture, can you explain the form of the building? Because I think you've played with space, you've played with light, you've played with color. It's not a traditional shaped building. Would you tell us a little bit about the structure?
Well, one of the challenges that I was broached about from the client was that we had to get 32 units, and that number of units penciled out for her. It has to be a project that works for the client, also works from our perspective in terms of pushing architecture. So we took a very simple idea of a rectangle, and we pushed in the middle parts of the rectangle to create a very slight radius curve to those. In addition to that, we also created a courtyard that is an elliptical shape. So it brings in wonderful light towards the center of the building. So there is a playfulness with regards to the building, but a very simple playfulness, where the exterior of the building has a radius curve on all four elevations, so it's very democratic in terms of the architectural quality. Each window and each balcony has this very simple box, whether it's black or white, that provides shade. Equally so provides an opportunity for people to go out and stand on their balconies. So it's a hybrid between window shading and balconies. But that simple move and the patterning of the building was extremely important. So it's very choreographed, the building. So you can take a simple form, and if you choreograph it with regards to the proportions, the shape, the geometry, the pure volume it is, and bring light and passive and sustainable strategies, which this building does. All the units are accessed from the exterior, which means you can open one window on one side and one window on the other and get cross ventilation, so therefore you don't have to turn on the AC.
And I'm interested in how architects pick up ideas throughout their career. You were born in Dublin, you spent a lot of time in London. You're here in LA, where there is debatably one of the most pressing concerns about housing. As we look over to downtown, there's a huge inequality and, I'd say, lack of housing. What kind of lessons are you offering up in this building? Obviously, there's the use of the roof, there's the affordability in the space, but is there anything that you think could be taken from here and maybe used elsewhere in Los Angeles as a bit of a prompt for other architects, or maybe your future work?
Right. Well, I'm convinced that Los Angeles will continue to have greater density. People are moving into cities because they're rejecting the car to a degree. They want to be able to live at a place where they can walk down to the street and go and buy something in a shop or grab lunch or a cup of coffee. So as the city gets more dense, it's extremely important to see buildings as having a relationship between the public-private domain. We did write a book called Amplified Urbanism, which talks about those issues, about how do you amplify your projects so it engages the city. And that's the more critical issue with our work. all of these type of projects need to have a stronger, greater impact within the city. When you finish these projects, they're here for 30 to 50 years, if not longer. So you feel a sense of accountability, and we want to do a work of consequence with our work, and that drives our work. Every project we do is looking at those aspects. How can we engage? How can we create expanded bandwidth of sidewalks? How can we create places to rest, places to gather? This project represents that. This roof we're on right now is used in a very public way, that there are individuals who live in the building who every Friday afternoon have a happy hour, and they invite friends and colleagues to come up on the roof. So there is, in a sense, a quasi-public space up here, which is not simply for the people in the building, but for their friends and colleagues. So this has become a very robust gathering space for the city, where people in the building invite friends and colleagues. It's really wonderful on Friday afternoons and early evenings up here on the roof.
So, Lorcan, in my time in town, I've had the good fortune to speak to a lot of people. I spoke recently to the city's chief design officer, who was the architecture critic for the LA Times for many years, and he wants to raise the level of debate around architecture, design, and urbanism in the city. Should architects be a little bit more political? Should you be wading into issues with the built environment in the public realm rather than just always focusing on private projects? How do you see that as an architect and a teacher?
That's a wonderful question. I am convinced the role of the architect is to do work of consequence. It isn't simply creating these projects that are formally inventive, but one has to do bring aesthetics, but also recognize the importance of engaging the city in multiple ways. And that's the work we try to do in our practice.
And my sincere thanks to Lorcan O'Herlihy of LOHA Architects, who is speaking to me on the roof of Mariposa 1038, his building in Los Angeles' Koreatown. And as promised, after a fitting interval, we'll return to my discussion on architecture and film with Kyle Bergman, the director of the Architecture and Design Film Festival, and critic, filmmaker, and Los Angeles' chief design officer, Christopher Hawthorne.
Kyle, you touched on it a little while ago. The appetite, I suppose, for the general public for films about architecture and about design is, to my untrained eye, peaking. I think, you know, you have directors like Gary Hustwit and people who are showing a different perspective, who are bringing stories to bear about the products that we use every day and the spaces that we inhabit. Is the public ready for a broader discussion about these kind of topics, and is that what you're really interested in starting in this debate?
So I think definitely yes, compared to when we started. When we started, we never even used the word documentary. It was kind of a dirty word still at that point. And 10 years later, now Netflix has a whole... I mean, documentary is now a hot word, and people want documentaries of all sorts of different types. So I think we were lucky to be at the right time. And I think the public is hungry. I mean, Netflix did a series called Abstract, which was about design. It was very, very well received. Wim Wenders did a whole 6-part 3D film called Cathedrals of Culture, and Robert Redford directed one of those. You know, so I think the general film world is getting more involved, and the general public is.
So if I was going to be a bit controversial, I'd say that there would be an element of delicacy that you need to approach that with, to, I guess, toe a line between being intellectual but being entertaining and showing people, I suppose, that issues of urbanism, you know, reuse, regeneration, are actually what goes on next door, not just what goes on in an ivory tower or a professor's office. You know, how does a chief design officer of a city get involved in those conversations, you know, beyond film festivals such as this? How do you get people involved and kind of up for the discussion?
So largely my job is in the policy realm. So we're thinking in the mayor's office about setting a policy agenda for the built environment and in terms of the work that I'm doing. But a big part of that is beginning to allow people to envision a different Los Angeles without the kind of anxiety that sometimes is prompted by that conversation. So, for example, we're having a lot of conversations about housing affordability and homelessness crisis in Los Angeles, and we have to have some more discussions about density and housing and the relationship between land use and transportation, for example. And so that's a policy conversation, but it's also a conversation about using architecture in particular in a discourse around architecture to allow people to envision the benefits that change might bring, as well as the kind of anxiety that sometimes that conversation occasions, and the ways in which improvements or changes to those policies can really bring positive change to people's neighborhoods. So it's really about the marriage of policy and the kind of conversation around it. And certainly in my old job as an architecture critic, I was translating one kind of a discourse within architecture to a broad reading public. So in some ways, there's a similar kind of translation, and I think something similar in the documentary as well.
Chris, last question. I really enjoy, usually with practicing architects, the more famous the better, asking them carte blanche that if they could design anything, what would it be? I remember Issei Weinfeld said a brothel, which was interesting. I think the typographer Eric Spiekerman wanted to do a car. He loves his car. But as a filmmaker and as someone in a kind of city hall position, what do you think is the topic that we should be talking about, the building that we should be reconsidering, the thing that you would like to spend your time exploring next if you were given free rein to make a film? What would it be?
I would answer that question by saying I'm thinking about two ends of the scale. So I think it's a fascinating moment to think about the tall building in Los Angeles. So one of the things I've learned in my job is that we have a de facto height limit in the form of a 13:1 FAR, floor area ratio, cap in Los Angeles, but that's actually in the city charter. So if we ever wanted to have pockets where we had super tall buildings, where we wanted to have a conversation about height, we'd have to take that question to the voters. And it turns out, as I was looking into the history of that detail in the charter, that there's a long history of ballot measures and really wide-ranging civic conversations in Los Angeles about this question of height. And I think they're really good arguments on both sides of the question. A lot of people have argued over the decades, going back to the 19-teens, that Los Angeles would never be a globally important city unless we embraced verticality. The other side of the equation saying, I left New York or Chicago to come to a place like Los Angeles because of its horizontal quality, because of the freedom sort of embodied in that notion. And the last thing we want is for Los Angeles to turn into Manhattan. And so it would be fascinating to imagine what a 21st century version of that debate would look like. So architects like Irving Gill, who's still really underappreciated, he deserves a film, in my opinion. He was really doing really ruthlessly spare, flat-roofed modernism as early as or perhaps even earlier than anyone in Europe and earlier than Loos. And I think in an international context, he's really underappreciated. But Neutra, Schindler, all the emigres were doing really innovative multifamily work, and that continued through the middle decades of the 20th century. So it's not just about producing a new paradigm for living more efficiently. It's also looking back to our own history. So I would say I'm interested in the two ends of the spectrum, in the very tall building and the very short building.
Many thanks to Christopher Hawthorne, LA's Chief Design Officer, and Kyle Bergman, the Director of the Architecture and Design Film Festival, for joining me there. Do check out Christopher Hawthorne's film on the Los Angeles residences of Frank Lloyd Wright, and look out for the next installment of the Architecture and Design Film Festival. You won't regret it. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. Don't forget, if you ever need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our brilliantly named sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra. You can also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, you lucky things, and look out on newsstands for the Salone special, the Milan Design Week paper, which is in production now. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis, edited by the saintly patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.